Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Yes, the headlines might be all politics, but believe you me, most of the actual news this week, it was the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 25th of May today. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. It kind of felt like about a week and a half. This one did, didn't it? Trade war on or off. North Korea on or off. So much to talk about, so little time. John Harwood is with CNBC. Sheila Kolhatkar is with The New Yorker magazine. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Sheila, let me start with you. And I want to start with the car tariff investigation that the president started on Wednesday, I guess it was, the Section 232 national security investigation. Given that we make so many foreign cars here in this country, right, from Toyotas to Mercedes to BMWs, and most of our cars come from our allies, what is the actual game here, do you imagine, that the president is shooting for?
Well, there's a lot of lurching from one thing to another, and it's hard to know whether anything that comes out of the Trump administration in this area is really by design, if these mixed signals are part of a strategy, or whether it's just simple chaos. And of course, Mexico and Canada are two of the largest suppliers of cars to the U.S. market. So this move will definitely put pressure on them at a time when NAFTA is still under renegotiation. So it is certainly possible that that is a tactic in that larger negotiation.
John Harwood, give me some insight into the whole national security part of this and how cars fit into that equation that the president is using.
It's bogus. We do not have a national security problem with the supply of cars in the United States. What the president is doing is looking for a way to rattle some cages, let his base know that he's looking out for them, and try to get concessions. You know, on the bark bite continuum, the president does a lot of barking, with the idea that that can intimidate his counterparties into negotiating with him. Doesn't have a lot to show for that so far. So I'm not sure he's going to implement a national security tariff on imported cars, but he's certainly going to make some noise about it.
All right, so Sheila, let's turn to North Korea here for a second. And granted, we don't know what's going to happen with this meeting, whether it's on or off, or who even knows. But if it stays off, right, if things kind of go south, and given that the president has been relying on President Xi in China to help him out with the North Koreans a little bit, right? Kim Jong-un has been to Beijing or met with President Xi twice now. If the meeting stays off and the president no longer needs President Xi with the North Koreans, does the Chinese trade equation turn more harsh, I guess?
Well, I think, again, this is an area where President Trump has been losing credibility just because of that bark versus bite problem. He makes big threats. He makes promises. And then so far, nothing has really come to fruition. And this started with the threat of tariffs on China. Then he sort of backed off on that. There have been vague statements and contradictions about whether China has agreed or not agreed to take steps to reduce the trade deficit. There was this whole flip-flop with this Chinese telecom company, ZTE
right.
about whether they're going to be allowed to continue, you know, to resume access to the U.S. market. So it seems to be in disarray. And, you know, it's hard to see how he kind of plays this North Korean collapse in his favor.
John, thoughts?
And Kai.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, look, first of all, the president's keeping alive the prospect of that summit. He did so today, which means he would continue to rely on China. So that sort of elimination of a consideration is not really eliminated. The second thing is that we were talking about bark and bite. When somebody can bite back at him, he has a tendency to back off. And we saw that on CTE. We've seen that when allies have complained about tariffs, he suspended the tariffs, and that creates another round of brinksmanship. The other consideration you can't ignore is that there is a Trump development in Indonesia that got $500 right. million dollars of financing linked to the Chinese government. So you don't know whether that is a consideration in how he approaches China.
Right. That's a Trump Organization development, right, from the private company that he owns and that his
that's right.
two oldest boys are in theory running. Sheila, John mentioned it really briefly. I do want to point out that next Friday is when the tariff steel and aluminum tariff exemptions that the Europeans and Canada and Mexico have gotten expire. And who knows what's going to happen there, he says, for not the first time on this radio program.
Well, so again, it's the same story. There are no real consistent signals from the Trump administration. It sounds like the EU officials are expecting them to expire. And, you know, from what I saw just today, the EU leaders apparently made an offer to Wilbur Ross, the Commerce right. Secretary. And the EU Trade Commissioner reported that the offer was not well received and that they're wow. basically trying to steel themselves, no pun intended, for the tariffs to go into effect once this expires. And then more chaos may ensue.
All right. We got to go. Sheila Kahatkar at The New Yorker Magazine. John Harwood at CNBC. Thanks, you two. Have yourselves a nice long weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. We'll see you. Wall Street today was a little bit bumpy. It lacked enthusiasm, really, one way or the other. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've been pointing out for a while now that global oil prices have been on the upswing. Demand has been brisk. Supply has been short. Price, of course, then becomes the dependent variable in that equation. The proximate cause has been production cuts by OPEC and Russia. But today, U.S. crude dropped 4% off the highs that it hit on Monday, three-year highs, it should be said, on word that those oil-producing countries might be opening up their spigots. Marketplace's Scott Tong looks at what that might mean for American drivers in this midterm election year.
Today, top energy ministers from Russia and Saudi Arabia said, enough. We're going to slowly add some more oil to world supply after a year and a half of being stingy. Their supply freeze had jacked up the world crude price by 50% to upwards of $80 a barrel. Why change now? Consultant Sarah Vakshuri at SVB Energy International notes the U.S. just reimposed sanctions on Iran. So Iran's oil buyers, to stay out of sanction trouble, need new sources of oil.
To be able to comply with the sanctions and cut their imports from Iran, they need to have a substitute supply in the market.
May as well come from OPEC or Russia. For these petrostates, high prices aren't always good. They could slow the world economy and hit the wallets of their customers in, say, China or India. Tom Kloza is analyst at Oil Price Information Service.
Perhaps $80 plus prices aren't necessarily good for an economy, a global economy that's running on all cylinders.
This change could bring some relief to American drivers. But there is this cliche about gas prices, that they rise like a rocket and fall like a feather. Kloza says gas station retailers have survived on teeny tiny profits as prices rose. So they may keep prices about where they are, at least through the summer driving season.
Now maybe they'll be able to get a little bit more margin and, you know, certainly the customers will be out there. We're looking for pretty brisk demand, and they may get healthy here for a while.
He thinks the national average, around $3 even for a gallon of regular, could start to feather down in the fall. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Fiat Chrysler announced a recall this morning. 4.8 million vehicles in the United States because drivers might not be able to turn off the cruise control on some Jeep, Dodge, Chrysler, and Ram models. The company says the solution is to be found in a software update, suggesting, perhaps, that the problem was faulty software in the first place. Tesla, kind of the same thing this week. Consumer Reports said it couldn't recommend the Model 3 because it takes too long to stop from 60 miles an hour, so CEO Elon Musk said the company would push a software fix. So with our cars increasingly becoming rolling computers, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein looks at the software and driver safety.
You know the term auto mechanic? It's a relic, says Tyler Hubbard, co-owner of I-70 Auto Service in Kansas City.
A mechanic is somebody who can probably change some parts on the vehicle, you know.
Hubbard says now a car can have 50 tiny computers inside or more.
We're technicians. the level of knowledge that these guys have to work on these vehicles, it amazes me on a daily basis.
Today, when a car rolls out of the plant, Hubbard says it's not really complete. That's because manufacturers keep updating the software to fine-tune the car or repair something. But Consumer Reports' Jake Fisher says those updates could go sideways.
The question is, when is the first time an automaker is going to make an update and maybe there's a software problem and they try to improve something and they make it worse?
Here's another thing. As cars become more reliant on computers and software, some people worry about the possibility that our Fords, Subarus, and Toyotas will become easy targets for hackers. NYU security expert Justin Kapos.
There's tremendous capability to go and do harm. This isn't something that's like kind of isolated to one automaker. It's really a large problem that has touched many parts of the industry.
Capo says these automakers have already basically become software companies. And as we move towards cars that drive themselves, car companies have to hit the gas on the security and safety of their software. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This is, by and large, a happy season for a certain set of people, those graduating high school or college and setting out on their way in this economy. But the graduates of 10 years ago had little to be happy about, facing as they were the worst job market in a generation. Our project about the financial crisis in the last 10 years in our economic lives is called Divided Decade. Today, our series on how the Great Recession changed pretty much everything, which we're calling How We Changed, takes us to Joel Rahn out of Commerce Township, Michigan.
In 2007, I'm getting ready to graduate high school. People were just losing jobs left and right. And being on my parents' street at home and looking down the block and seeing a bunch of foreclosed homes, it just was scary. After getting out of college and actually having a career, the first loan payments start rolling in, and it's pretty brutal. I kind of wish I'd never went to college. Me and my wife make around $105,000 a year. And like growing up, I thought, wow, that's, you know, insane. I'm making way more than my parents ever did. But knowing that I have all these student loans to pay back, it just seems like I'm not making much progress and I don't really have much at the end of the month. We did buy a house last year, so that did add more to our payments. And knowing what happened during the financial crisis and knowing how mortgage companies ripped off America, it almost makes you angry to have to sign essentially your life away to a mortgage company that just treats you as another number. I feel like the financial crisis made me bitter at a very young age. Being 28, I feel like I did quite a bit right as far as like the goals that you expect for someone to be an adult. I have a house. I got married. My son was born a month ago. But then thinking about like the money I make and all I'm doing is just collecting more debt, you're caught in a way. The things that you would like to do or the time that you think you have, it doesn't mean a lot when you have something hanging over your head.
We've got some pictures of Joel Rahn up on our Instagram. We're at MarketplaceAPM. And while you're there, tell us how the financial crisis changed you. The hashtag we're using is How We Changed. Coming up,
they're spending hours per week, you know, rifling through the racks at Salvation Army, Goodwill.
Nobody said running a side hustle was easy, you know. First, though, let's do the numbers. Heading into the long weekend, the Dow Industrial's down about 0.25%, 58 points, 24,753. The S&P 500 also off just short of 0.25%, 6 points, 27,21. The NASDAQ up a little bit more than 0.1%, 9 points. closed at 74.33. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow gained a little more than 0.1%. The S&P 500 picked up about 0.3%. NASDAQ advanced just shy of 0.1%. Today, you heard about falling oil prices from Scott Tong. ExxonMobil dipped nearly 2%. Today, Chevron gave up 0.3%. Clothing retailer Gap shrank 14.5% today. That after posting disappointing sales figures, Gap struggled to clear extra inventory in a quarter marked by a long and cruddy winter. Foot Locker, though, up 20% after the company beat sales estimates for the quarter. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.93%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, it's Kai. You hear me say it all the time. Watch the bond market if you want to understand the economy. Well, you should also watch our YouTube channel for quick video explainers, things you've always wondered about, stories beyond the headlines. Subscribe on YouTube or at Marketplace APM. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Starbucks is going to close 8,000 stores next Tuesday afternoon. Anti-bias training for 175,000 employees after the incident in Philadelphia last month. It's going to cost the company as much as $12 million in lost revenue. And the specific kind of training that baristas are going to get is called implicit bias training, a specialty that is becoming more popular in corporate America. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank reports.
Inside this crowded Starbucks in downtown L.A., I caught up with some regulars who said the company is making the right move.
It's the kind of thing that any customer service organization should do, make sure that its employees are treating people well.
I've never had an issue at any of the Starbucks that I've been to, but I think it was the smart thing for them to do.
It's kind of funny that a corporation is the one that's doing it, because I think the problem is systemic throughout society.
That's Michael Phillips, Chavez Frazier, and Yosef Mahmoud. So what is implicit bias training? Academics have been studying unconscious preferences for decades. But in the last few years, implicit bias has become the hot topic in corporate diversity programs and the cornerstone of anti-bias efforts in Silicon Valley. About 20% of large U.S. companies provide unconscious bias training, according to the Future Work Institute. Michelle Kim is CEO at Awaken, a company that's helped facilitate trainings for Google and PG&E.
Unconscious bias training has been trending for the last couple of years, I would say. I think a lot of companies sometimes view training as like a silver bullet to a lot of their problems.
Kim says these programs aim to educate people about the concept of unconscious bias and expose participants to their own implicit preferences for certain social groups. She says while these programs are popular, in a way, they let people off the hook.
It could be seen as an easier topic to digest versus, let's say, talking about racism, talking about sexism. You know, it just feels a little bit less polarizing to a lot of people.
Diversity training is an $8 billion a year industry, with vendors offering everything from a few PowerPoint slides to online modules to live instructor trainings that can cost thousands of dollars per session. Joelle Emerson is CEO at Paradigm, a diversity strategy firm that's worked with more than 300 companies, including Airbnb, Twitter, and Slack.
There are a lot of trainings that exist in this space, but we don't know a lot about how effective they are.
Emerson says Paradigm's trainings are data-driven and based on social science research. The best training programs, she says, are designed with clear goals in mind and measure the impact they're having. Starbucks customer Yosef Mahmoud is a corporate lawyer and has been through implicit bias training at his job.
The training is a helpful reminder that as much as we don't want to see race, that we do, and we do make assumptions based on that.
But does a helpful reminder actually help? In the most comprehensive study on the impact of diversity programs, sociologist Alexandra Kalev followed more than 800 U.S. companies over three decades. She says when managers are engaged in leading the implicit bias training, it works. On the other hand,
programs that try to tie the hands of managers do not succeed in the best case and actually cause harm in most cases.
Simply telling people they're not alone in their biases can backfire, according to a study published in the Journal of Applied Psychology. If people are told stereotyping is normal, it can make them less compelled to manage their prejudices. Still, Kalev estimates about 60% of large U.S. companies do some kind of diversity training.
They're a good way to fight bad press or prevent potential lawsuits.
But Kalev says without long-term strategies, training alone is a bad way to actually change workplace behavior. Starbucks has enlisted former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and the NAACP to advise its effort. The company says the May 29th training is just step one of many. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Social media is for letting you connect with your friends. Yes, also you can find news, restaurant recommendations maybe, roommates perhaps. Also, stuff to buy. By clicking on an ad, yes, but increasingly people straight up saying in a post, hey, you want to buy this? Case in point, vintage clothing on Instagram. Alexander Stratton wrote about it recently for Bloomberg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
All right, you have to help me understand how this works. You're flipping through your Instagram feed, you see a post or an ad and you decide you want to buy it? Is it that simple?
It's a new kind of consumerism, really. You know, people have started creating vintage stores on Instagram. And yeah, you can follow these accounts and they post different vintage outfits every day. And if you're the first one to comment, you can have the outfit.
So you got to be quick.
Exactly. They'll just direct message each other and say, you know, here's the cost. And they conduct the payment through PayPal or another, you know, Venmo or right. another
sort of peer-to-peer financing thing, right?
Right.
How does it work on the seller's back end? I mean, do they have to go and source all these vintage clothes they're selling and then they got to do photo shoots and the whole deal, right? I imagine it's
right.
sort of labor intensive.
They're spending hours per week, you know, rifling through the racks at Salvation Army, Goodwill, and also like estate sales to find these outfits. And then, you know, it's pretty simple. They take photos of the outfits, post them to their account. They often clean the items up as well since they are vintage. So they'll mend them, clean them. Yeah.
And how much are they making? I mean, if I decide to get into this line of work, how much can I clear?
You know, it varies because some people opt to have this as, you know, a so-called side hustle where they can mm-hmm. make a couple hundred extra bucks per week. For other people, this has morphed into their full-time profession, and they can accrue up to $5,000 in sales per week.
Wow, that's not terrible.
Which kind of makes you think, yeah. you know, is this something I should get into?
Totally. But let me ask you this. You know, social media has been around for a decent number of years now, and we have yet to see people actually actively as a habit shopping on social, right? What happens is they see stuff on social, and then they flip to Instagram, or they got to some brick-and-mortar place, and then they buy it. Do you suppose this is sort of the cutting edge of a new way of buying stuff?
You know, I think people, as social media is becoming more prevalent, I do think people are becoming more comfortable with the idea of purchasing directly from social media, especially with how easy Instagram has made it. You know, it's working with retailers now so that people can actually purchase things directly. They don't have to leave the app to buy things.
Right.
And I think that that's fairly seamless for the consumer. And in this time when, you know, people are sort of rejecting the brick and mortar with all of its pain points. They're looking for something seamless. And I think social media is, you know, working to offer them that.
Now this is radio, so I can't see it, but my guess is you're closer to the demographic that Instagram wants than perhaps I am. So let me ask you this. Are you going to do more shopping like this on social, whether it's Pinterest or Twitter or Instagram or whatever?
You know, I myself, I do fall into the demographic. I think part of the reason why millennials are so attracted to this kind of shopping is because we're seeing them reject fast fashion. People in this generation are starting to realize, you know, the toll that that takes on the environment.
Huh.
And so this vintage shopping is just one way that they're sort of like trying to be more meaningful with their dollar.
Alexander Stratton writes at Bloomberg. Alexander, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, perhaps you have seen the stories this week about Tesla's CEO Elon Musk and how he's a tad miffed at some of the unflattering coverage his company has been getting lately. The breaking anecdote in Dan Gorenstein's introduction a couple of minutes ago, for one example. Musk says he is going to start up a website called Pravda, where the public can rate the credibility and truth of any story it sees. Pravda, you may or may not know, was the name of the main state propaganda outlet in the Soviet Union. It's also the Russian word for truth, so here is a little truth. It's from Tesla's most recent annual report filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Quote, historically, we've been able to generate significant media coverage of our company and our vehicles, and we believe we will continue to do so. To date, for vehicle sales, media coverage and word of mouth have been the primary drivers of our sales leads and have helped us achieve sales without traditional advertising and at relatively low marketing costs. End of quote. Full disclosure, we here at Marketplace have helped Tesla out quite a bit, too. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's off about 0.25% today, 58 points. S&P 500 also off just short of 0.25%. That's 6 points. NASDAQ was up, though, about 0.1%, 9 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a good long weekend, everybody. If you got Monday off, we are back on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.